Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Rest of His Days by Pamela Taylor, narrated by Alex Wyndham. It is recorded that in the year of our Lord 1327, on the 21st day of September, Edward of Carnarvon, until earlier in that year King of England, was murdered at Berkeley Castle in Gloucestershire. He was buried in Gloucester Cathedral on the 20th day of December. For 550 years, this was the undisputed history of the fate of Edward II of England. Then, in 1878, a letter was discovered that claimed otherwise. It was found in a cartulary belonging to the Bishop of Maguelonne in France, a letter to Edward III from Manuele Fieschi, a priest and papal notary. The authenticity of this letter is not in question, nor is the fact that it is contemporaneous with the events described. Its veracity, however, remains a matter of debate among historians. What if the Fieschi letter is true? Chapter 1. April 1327.
"What now?" Sir Guy muttered as he strode up the slight rise from the stables. The servant who'd brought the message had been no help.
"All I know is my lord the Earl wants to see you, and he said I'd best make haste to find you."
Sir Guy was a big man, tall, when he stood beside his 16 hands destrier, the top of his head rose above the horse's withers, tall and well-muscled. In full armour and with his home in place, he was an imposing figure even before he cradled his lance and began the charge toward his opponent. Gossip among the squires said more than one opponent had veered away at the last minute to avoid a direct hit on the shield arm or the breastplate. Better to be unhorsed by a glancing blow and live to joust another day than to lose everything in the lists, or so the gossip said. Making his way past the keep, Guy entered the leftmost of the two new buildings in the castle compound. New being relative, of course. They were built when King John added the outer wall and expanded the mere, making Kenilworth well-nigh impregnable. It was said that Henry III had undertaken some refurbishments when he took the castle back from Simon de Montfort after the siege in 1266. But it was Thomas, the present Earl's predecessor, who was responsible for its current luxurious furnishings, and it was into the Earl's own presence chamber that Sir Guy was shown.
"Ah, bigger staff. They found you quickly, I see."
Seated at his writing table, the Earl acknowledged his visitor, then rummaged among the papers in front of him, finally finding the right one and proffering it to Guy.
"Read that."
"My dear Lancaster, our hopes have been dashed that the difficulties attendant on an attempted assault on Kenilworth would be sufficient to discourage those who might seek to free the personage we gave into your charge. Though we are grateful for your success in repelling the efforts of the Dominican and his brother, it now seems prudent to remove your charge to a different location. 2 days before Palm Sunday, you may expect the arrival of our well-beloved Lord Berkeley and his companion, Sir John Maltravers. They are under orders to take custody of the aforementioned personage and convey him to his new permanent lodgings at Berkeley Castle. The men-at-arms who serve you as his guards are hereby ordered to render that service to Berkeley and Maltravers for as long as those two shall deem necessary. As from Palm Sunday, your stipend for the care and comfort of said personage is revoked, but you retain all other rights heretofore granted you by the Crown. Isabella R."
Affixed to the message was the King's Privy Seal. Finished reading, Sir Guy handed back the page without comment.
"It seems I'm to be relieved of responsibility for the prisoner," said Lancaster. "Not a moment too soon for my liking. Let Berkeley have him."
The Earl folded the page and stowed it in a drawer of his table.
"And all the problems that come with being both host and jailer."
He rose from his chair and began pacing to and fro in front of the hearth.
"Comfortable captivity,"
he snorted.
"He's comfortable, but I'm the one who feels like a captive."
"But at least, sir, you're free to come," Sir Guy ventured to offer reassurance, but Lancaster cut him off.
"Free to come and go as I please? Spare me the platitude, Bickerstaff. I don't leave here lest some band of plotters steal him away in my absence."
"But isn't it my job to prevent that?"
"Your job, but my responsibility. God's bodkin, man, who do you think they'd throw in the tower if their precious prisoner be stolen away? And what am I to do if a parliament is summoned? Stay here and lose my voice in matters of state, or attend and risk a lot more than losing my voice?"
His rant apparently exhausted, the Earl returned to his seat behind the writing table.
"Let Berkeley have him, I say. I'd rather live without the constant worry of who's hatching the next plot or what new wind's going to blow from Mortimer's arse. Barclay should be immune from that, at least, or maybe accustomed to it.
Lancaster allowed himself a chuckle at the idea.
Given that he's Mortimer's son-in-law.
Guy kept his expression neutral and his thoughts to himself.
Looks like you aren't so lucky, Bickerstaff. Tomorrow's Friday. God knows when they'll arrive, so you don't have much time to get your men organized. Best get to it, then. I'll inform our guest.
The Earl waved his hand in dismissal, Guy's cue to leave. Once outdoors and headed across the open lawn toward the old Norman keep where he and his men lodged, Sir Guy's frustration got the better of him.
God's teeth, he exclaimed to no one in particular. Why me? What dastardly sin did I commit that's landed me in this purgatory on earth? Did I covet this knighthood so much that the moment I received it I'm given the worst job in all of England?
No sooner had the Queen lifted the sword from his shoulder and said,
Rise, Sir Guy,
than she'd added,
Now, the first service I require from you is that you assemble a cadre of men-at-arms and proceed with all due haste to join the Earl of Lancaster and put yourself and your men at his disposal. The Earl is even now making his way to Neath in Wales.
The only reply available to Sir Guy was a bow and a simple,
Yes, Your Grace.
In the normal course of things, a newly minted knight didn't question the wishes of he or she who just elevated his rank in society. God knew that was the only ordinary thing about this whole situation. That it was the Queen who'd knighted him wasn't the first bizarre turn in this particular drama. That it was the Queen who'd invaded her own kingdom was what had started it all. It had been, what, over 2.5 centuries since the last invasion, when William of Normandy put paid to the last Anglo-Saxon king and took the throne and the kingdom for himself. But a queen invading her own kingdom not to oust an occupier, but in opposition to her own husband, that was passing strange indeed. Nevertheless, London quickly rose up in support of Isabella. They'd had their fill of the Despensers, the king's current favourites and the objects of Isabella's fury. The Despensers were widely hated because of their theft of lands and extortion of merchants and nobles alike, general corruption, theft from the treasury, and even, in the case of Hugh the Younger, piracy in the English Channel, none of which Edward made any effort to curtail. The Earl of Lancaster also threw his support to the Queen the moment her forces landed on English soil. Guy considered himself an upright and righteous man. Reverence for his God and loyalty to his king, in that order, formed the core of his beliefs and guided his every action. So the extraordinary turn of events was more than a little unsettling. But that was nothing compared to what happened once he caught up with Lancaster at Llanelltid on the banks of the River Neath. He was brought straight to the Earl, who was poring over some sort of diagram with two other men. Guy cleared his throat, making his presence known, and the Earl looked up.
Sir Guy Bickerstaff, my lord, here at the behest of the Queen with my men-at-arms.
To the other two, the Earl said,
That'll be all for now. Just make sure your men are ready in the morning.
Then he turned his attention to Guy and surveyed him from head to toe.
Bickerstaff, you say?
Aye, my lord.
How many men-at-arms?
20, my lord.
Good, and just in time.
The Earl snapped his fingers, and the last two men in the tent, presumably servants, scurried out, leaving Guy and Lancaster alone.
Sit,
said the Earl, pointing to a stool beside the small camp table. It was more an order than an invitation. He took the only chair for himself.
Do you know why you're here?
All I know is that I'm to put myself and my men at your disposal, sir.
Very well. On the morrow, we take the king into custody. My information is that he's ready to put an end to the madness and come quietly, but I'm taking no chances. Even if he's ready, God knows what those around him think. That's why I have enough men here to suppress anything the force still inside Neath Castle might take it into their heads to do.
He paused to take a sizable swallow of whatever was in the mug on the table.
And we're to join with your men.
Guy felt a need to fill the silence.
Quite the contrary. You're to stay out of the fray, if there is one. When we have the king's person secured, you're to take charge of him and get him safely to Monmouth. I'll stay here to deal with whoever's left, and then I have to go give evidence in the younger Despenser's trial, though the outcome of that is a foregone conclusion. For now, if word gets out that the king has surrendered, his supporters are going to assume he's with me, so they'll pay little or no attention to your small band headed east. Your route will, of necessity, put you in the vicinity of Abergavenny Castle. You should have nothing to fear from them. The Baron is married to one of Mortimer's daughters.
but avoid drawing attention to yourselves anyway. And once we reach Monmouth, sir, wait there for me. Keep the king under guard. Choose a couple of servants to tend to his needs and provide food. But Bickerstaff, the queen's orders are that he's not to be harmed, only to be confined to the premises with no access to anyone I haven't personally approved. And so far, I haven't approved anyone but you.
In the end, the journey was uneventful, but that didn't mean Sir Guy wasn't on edge for the entire 2.5 days. What surprised him was just how compliant the king was, subdued even. And later, at Monmouth, after Lancaster had joined them, when the queen sent her envoy to fetch the king's privy seal so she could rule in his name, Edward handed it over willingly.
Yet another peculiarity in this drama of the bizarre.
Guy had asked Lancaster about it.
"He's trying to win her back," said the Earl, "doing his best to convince her that he's put the Despensers behind him and wants them to rule together as king and queen. Though if you ask me, I don't think there's much chance of that now that she's with Mortimer."
Whether it was Mortimer's influence or Isabella's own reluctance to take another chance, after all, Edward had behaved himself for a time after Piers Gaveston's execution until the Despensers came on the scene, Lancaster's prediction was prescient. Parliament, sitting at Wallingford, deposed the king in favour of his 14-year-old son, who was crowned Edward III with his mother as regent. That same Parliament acceded to Isabella's insistence that her husband come to no harm and declared that he should live in comfortable captivity for the rest of his natural life. England had never deposed a king before. Kings died of disease or in battle, and no one quite knew what to do with him. But Kenilworth was generally reckoned one of the most unassailable places in the kingdom, so Lancaster wound up with the short end of the staff, and Sir Guy wound up in the unenviable position of showing loyalty to his new king by serving as prison warden to the old one. Finding no one on the ground floor of the keep, Sir Guy dashed up the steps to the first floor, where a few of his men not on duty were tending to their weapons.
"New orders, men," he announced. "We're moving the prisoner again. Tomorrow, jump to it and get the troop ready for the journey."
"Not again,"
Aldwyn, the senior man at arms, complained.
"Don't they know every minute on the road is a chance for someone to grab him?"
"Ours not to reason why, Aldwyn."
"Where to this time?"
"Barclay Castle. Lord Barclay's arriving sometime tomorrow. Our orders are to put ourselves at his disposal."
"Why Barclay? It's no safer than here."
"Mortimer's doing, I suspect. Lancaster is Isabella's man and Edward's first cousin. Mortimer probably wants to put his own man in charge."
Sir Guy paused and looked around the room.
"Where's Will?"
Aldwyn shrugged.
"Haven't seen him since we came off duty at midday. I'd wager he's off drinking in the village."
"Aye,"
chimed in a man in the far corner of the room.
"Taking quite a fancy to that new barmaid he has."
Guy tried not to grimace.
"All right, Aldwyn, send someone to fetch him back."
"Begging your pardon, sir, but if you really want him back, you'd best fetch him yourself. He'd just tell any of us to take a leap into the mere. And he's your cousin, after all."
"Second cousin," Guy growled. "All right, I'll go, but I want to see everything ready when I get back."
He spun on his heel and stormed down the stairs.
"God's bollocks, what else could go wrong today?"
he raged at the empty courtyard. "That's going to cost me more than a couple of Hail Marys," Guy thought. "At least no one heard me. Maybe I don't have to confess to the priest exactly how I took the Lord's name in vain. Of course I wouldn't put it past him to ask."
But Aldwyn was right. Will Makepeace went his own way and didn't give much of a damn what anyone else thought.
"Will make trouble, more like," thought Guy. "What in God's name were his parents thinking when they named him William? Didn't they know people would call him Will? And what was I thinking when I made him part of this troop?" "About your promise to his mother," Guy reminded himself. "You swore on her deathbed you'd look after him. If only I'd known what I was signing up for."
Chapter 2. It wasn't the barmaid Will had come to see today, though he was at pains to ensure that's what everyone believed, giving her backside a pat when she served them and eyeing her up and down whenever she passed by. No, it was the man across the table, draining the last drop of ale from his mug, who was the reason for Will's presence. Will had known Simon since they were boyhood friends in London, where Will's father, a master mason, was involved in the new work, the Eastwood Extension at St. Paul's Cathedral. Simon's father was a man-at-arms in Edward Longshank's service. Shortly after Will's 11th birthday, his father was invited to come work on raising the tower and spire at Salisbury Cathedral,
It was exceedingly dangerous work, but the wages were an astonishing 6 pennies a day, so the family immediately packed up and moved west. The lad's paths didn't cross again until Will wandered into the bar at the inn not long after his arrival at Kenilworth and noticed what seemed like a vaguely familiar face drinking alone at a table by the small window on the far side of the room. While he waited for the landlord to pour his mug of ale, Will inclined his head toward the window and asked, "Who's that man over there?"
"Been staying here the last couple of nights. Says he's from Gloucester, but he's pretty close-mouthed about his business. Keeps to himself and doesn't cause any trouble. Pays his room and board every day. That's all I care about."
Will put half a farthing on the bar, picked up his mug, and wandered across the room. "Care to join me?" the man asked when Will approached. "Best spot in the place. I come early to claim it before the others get here." Setting his mug on the table, Will asked, "Do I know you?"
"I hope you do, because for certs I know you. You haven't changed a bit. Well, become a man and all, but I'd know that face anywhere. Will Makepeace."
He rose from the table and spread his arms wide.
"It's me, Simon. Simon Forster."
The open arms became a bear hug as Simon went on with his exuberant greeting. A bit over-exuberant to Will's way of thinking, but Simon had always been the more gregarious of the two. Releasing his friend at last, Simon added,
"Sit, sit."
Will took a big swallow from his mug.
"Well, this is certainly unexpected."
"Indeed," said Simon.
"When we said farewell in London, I was sure I'd never see you again. What have you been doing with yourself?" "Threads and thrums. Never had Pa's talent with the stones, so I just picked up whatever bits of work I could find until my cousin came along and took me on as man-at-arms. That was last autumn, not long after Ma died. We're in service to the Earl of Lancaster. What about you? You look rather prosperous."
"It wasn't long after you left that my father got assigned to Edmund of Woodstock's household. Edmund was complaining about not having a companion his own age, so Father put me forward. The prince took to me straight away, even made up a title for me, Companion of the Privy Chamber, and that's what I've been ever since. We get on well enough, so I'm content with the arrangement. When his brother created him Earl of Kent, he was granted Gloucester Castle, and that's where we spend a lot of time now. I'm just passing through on the Earl's business." Over the next 2 hours, they'd re-established their acquaintance and made plans to meet again 2 weeks later, when Simon said he'd once again be passing through. That turned out to be a very different sort of meeting. They exchanged the usual pleasantries over the first mug of ale, but when the barmaid left after pouring their refills, Simon hunched over the table and lowered his voice.
"There's something I want to ask you, Will, but it's best not overheard. There's another reason I like this table, see? Here in this nook by the window, it's far enough away from the rest to make eavesdropping difficult. Anyway..."
He paused as Will put his forearms on the table and leaned forward.
"Edmund knows his half-brother Edward is at Kenilworth. Hell, everyone of any importance knows that. What he doesn't know is how his brother fares, if the comfortable captivity ordered by Parliament is being observed, and he'd like to hear about his brother from time to time. Mortimer and the Queen, Mortimer in particular, are suspicious of anyone who shows too much interest in the former king, so Edmund dare not make his own interest known."
"So how does this concern me?" asked Will. "You're part of Sir Guy's troop, right?"
Will hesitated, then nodded his head. How did Simon know this?
"So that probably means you come into Edward's presence from time to time? As a guard, but hardly to have a chat. Ah, but you know the servants who wait on him, I presume."
Will was growing suspicious. Where was this going? He took a long draught of ale.
"All Edmund wants is a way to get news of his brother from time to time without running afoul of Lancaster or Mortimer."
Simon supplied the answer.
"So you're asking me to take that risk instead? No risk to you, as I see it. You have a couple of mugs of ale with a childhood friend whenever he's passing through. How could anyone be suspicious, especially since the landlord witnessed our joyful reunion a couple of weeks back?"
Now the pieces were falling in place for Will. That reunion was no serendipity at all. Simon had carefully contrived it, and his exuberance was less for Will's benefit than for the landlord and everyone else in the bar that evening.
"What if I agree?" Will wondered. "Is this just the harmless first step down a path toward treason? I don't know Simon anything, and I most certainly don't know the Earl of Kent anything. On the other hand, Simon and I were inseparable as lads. Surely he wouldn't go out of his way to put me in jeopardy. But he could have changed over the years. Companion to a prince of the realm, that almost certainly changes a man's idea of who his friends are."
Noticing both mugs were empty, Will picked them up and walked to the bar, a chance for some more soul-searching. Despite what everyone said, Will felt rather sorry for Edward of Carnarvon, as the former king was now known. He'd never been a remarkable king. Some said he never wanted to rule, and he hadn't been strong enough to recognize when other men were using him for their personal benefit. But Will liked the man. He was kind to his servants, tolerant of his guards, pious enough. Will left a farthing on the bar, picked up the now full mugs, and started back toward the table.
"If you say yes, we'll make peace," he told himself. "Then you have to be prepared to say no if this turns in a direction you dare not go, even if that costs you Simon's friendship."
He placed the mugs on the table, perched on his stool, and took a long draught.
"You may tell your companion," Will spoke almost in a whisper, "that his brother is quite comfortable. He dines well, he walks about in the courtyard for exercise when the weather is fair, he attends chapel, all his wants are provided for." "That is exceeding good news. Thank you, Will. And should you find yourself in a position to speak to Edward circumspectly, perhaps you might mention that his half-brother inquired after his health?"
That had been almost 4 months ago. In the weeks since, Simon had brought news of growing support for Edward in various parts of England, but was always adamant that the Earl of Kent was not involved in any plots. On one recent visit, though, he mentioned that Kent was coming to regret his earlier support for the Queen and Mortimer.
"In truth, not so much the Queen," he added. "The Despensers had to go, but Mortimer's starting to take too much on himself, almost as if he believes he's the regent instead of the Queen. Isabella reins him in from time to time, but how long will it be before she can no longer control him?"
Somewhere along the way, Will had realized that his best protection lay in being seen regularly in the bar, whether Simon was there or not. It was costing him far more of his wages than he really wanted to spend, but a man can't afford to count the cost of keeping his head firmly on his shoulders and his entrails safely inside his belly. It was also costing him Guy's goodwill. But the former king seemed to take comfort in the fact that one man among his guards actually took an interest in his welfare. Now, Simon raised his empty mug in the air and waved it about to get the barmaid's attention. She wasted no time bringing the pitcher to pour him a refill. Will reached out his hand, intending to give her backside a squeeze, and she swatted it away.
"You keep your hands to yourself, Will Makepeace. I've had quite enough of that for one day."
Then she turned to him with an impish smile.
"Unless you have something more in mind."
She held out her hand.
"You got a penny you're itching to spend?"
"Not if I have to keep buying drinks for this cheap bastard."
Will laughed and dropped half a farthing in her hand for Simon's ale. The impish smile turned to a broad grin.
"About what I thought."
She winked at Will, then walked back to the bar with an exaggerated swing of her hips, obviously intended to arouse him, and every other man in the bar for that matter.
"By God, she knows how to get under a man's skin," said Simon.
They both quaffed a rather large swallow of ale in an effort to shake off the distraction.
"As I was saying," Simon returned to the conversation they'd begun earlier. "After the failed attack on Kenilworth, the Dunheavards and their gang managed to avoid being caught. According to my sources, Friar Thomas is holed up in a Dominican priory somewhere, and Stephen's gone to ground. No one has much of an idea where he might be. That doesn't mean they've given up. Just biding their time. You can be certain they'll try again."
No sooner had Simon finished the sentence than the room was bathed in a swath of sunlight as the door opened. Sir Guy stood there a moment, looking around the room, then shut the door behind him and strode directly to Will's table.
"Come on, Will," he said. "It's time to go."
"At least let me finish my ale. I've already paid for it."
"Then down it quickly. I've got things for you to do."
Guy stood with his arms crossed over his chest, his feet spread apart, the stance Will thought of as the stern father pose. Normally that would be enough for Will to do anything to avoid complying. It wasn't that he particularly liked provoking his cousin. It was just that now and then Guy could be so pompous and sanctimonious that Will couldn't help himself. But now was not the time. The last thing he needed was for his cousin to start asking questions about the man across the table. So he emptied his mug in two enormous gulps, rose from his stool and started toward the door, calling,
"Good journey, my good fellow,"
over his shoulder as Guy fell into step with him. Once they were outside and on the road to the castle, Will asked,
"So what did you think of the barmaid?"
"What barmaid?"
"Oh, come on, Guy, you can't play coy with me. I saw you eye her from head to toe as we walked out the bar. Pretty nice, eh? Enough to make any man's trousers bulge, even yours."
"Great God in heaven, I absolutely despair of you sometimes, Will Makepeace."
It was obvious Guy was in no mood for humour.
And of late you seem to be getting worse. Not a week goes by I don't get some report of you being off at the inn, sometimes twice in a week. Drinking and dallying with barmaids? What would your mother think? And what's wrong with drinking and barmaids? I've got nothing else to spend my wages on. Besides, the ale at that inn's a far sight better than what they brew at the castle. Then I'll just have to pray that the ale where we're going is better and that there's a village bylaw that keeps locals out of the inn. If there is, I'm sure there'll be a tavern for the locals.
As Guy's words finally registered, Will stopped in his tracks.
Wait a minute. What do you mean where we're going?
That's why I came to fetch you. We're to move the former king again, tomorrow, so you have to do your part to get ready.
Tomorrow? Will's tone was incredulous. Where?
Berkeley Castle. It's a damn sight safer to keep him here, but the Queen and her paramour seem to have other ideas, so move him we must.
They walked in silence the rest of the way to the castle, with Will contemplating that this offhand farewell to Simon was another parting that might be forever. Even worse, he had no way to let his friend know what was afoot. It wasn't the barmaid Guy had turned back to look at, but the man who'd been sitting across from Will.
Not someone from the village, but from elsewhere, Guy mused. What was it Will had said? Good journey, my good fellow. What's Will doing consorting with strangers? The barmaid for certs, at least that's what all the men say. Drinking with the locals, men he knows from the village. Hardly a worthwhile way for a man to spend his time or his money. But strangers?
Utterly unable to comprehend Will's good-natured affability, Guy felt compelled to attribute purpose to everything his cousin did. After all, that's how he lived his own life. Every thought, every deed, every spoken word chosen to preserve his honour and advance his position in life.
So what was Will up to? Why would a stranger passing through have any interest in Will? Guy wondered. Unless he knows Will's in my troop. And Will's so damn naive he'd never recognise when someone was plying him for information that would be useful to the plotters.
And then something else dawned on him. What if Will was actually in league with the plotters? Another reason to try to constrain his cousin's behaviour. Maybe this move to Berkeley was a good thing after all. Will needn't have worried about Simon learning about the move. As the procession passed by Gloucester Castle on Sunday, two men watched from the parapet.
It appears our informant was right, said Edmund.
He and his companion watched in silence for another moment before he added,
which leads me to wonder why your friend didn't mention this.
The same thought occurred to me, and yet on reflection I don't think he knew. His conversation on Thursday was as forthcoming as always, and he seemed in no hurry to leave. It was Sir Guy who came to fetch him, rather peculiar in and of itself, but the abrupt way he practically dragged Will out of the inn, speaking of duties to attend to, does lead one to think that those at Kenilworth had only just learned of the move.
Perhaps we shouldn't be surprised at that, Simon. Keeping the plan a closely held secret certainly reduces the chance of the wrong people getting wind of it.
They watched in silence as the carriage and its 20 armed escort slowed as it approached the turn onto the Bristol Road.
Isn't that Lord Berkeley's livery the coachmen are wearing? Asked Simon. Well spotted, my friend. So that's where they're taking him.
An interesting choice. Something of an out corner of the realm. But is that safer? Or might it be even better suited to the scheming of those who would see him freed and returned to the throne? Uncertain if the Earl really wanted to debate the question, or if he was simply musing aloud, Simon held his tongue, and then a smile spread across Edmund's face.
You know, Simon, it may happen that I'll have business in Bristol sometime in the coming months.
Chapter 3 Thanks to Edward's insistence on attending Palm Sunday Mass, the travellers' departure from Gloucester had been delayed until almost midday. Sir Guy had breathed a huge sigh of relief when Lord Berkeley stood firm against going to the cathedral, where Edward would certainly be recognised and it would be impossible to keep him separated from the throngs. Even at the small church just inside the town walls, Guy noticed that at least one of the worshippers appeared to have an inkling of the identity of the stranger in their midst. Fortunately, the solemnity of the service and a quick exit out a side door meant they were well on their way before anyone could start asking questions. The late departure meant that it would be impossible to reach their destination before sundown, but Guy decided this suited his purposes well. He'd been anxious about the arrival at Berkeley Castle. One could never know with any certainty exactly who or what might be lying in wait at any new destination. Now, though, he had an opportunity for more control over the situation. They camped in an open field just south of the river.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?